reach the Outrider Podcast.
Howdy, and welcome to the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott. I'm back from my hiatus of a sorts. Welcome to episode 12. We're going to do something a little different with this episode, kind of my attempt to diversify what I'm doing and maybe do something interesting and fun, I hope. I hope this is fun. Today, what I'm going to do is we're going to have story time. That didn't sound good, did it? Basically, I'm going to read to you a story from a writer that I admire greatly. And then after the story, we'll have a brief conversation with the writer, nothing like our normal episode. And we'll get in and out of here pretty quick. So I hope you enjoy it. I hope it goes well. I think the reading went pretty well. I recorded that separately. I'm going to insert that in here and do all of that. I'm going to be reading a story called Shadow Boxes by Laura Hawley. Laura, you probably haven't heard of, but she was part of the Naropa group that I was with, and she was kind of the first one to break out, and then she quietly vanished on us. She had a short story appear in the Madness 2 episode from the journal published by, I think it was San Diego State University. And then she got picked by Joyce Carol Oates for the Best New American Voices anthology from 2003. And she was the capper story, the story at the end of the anthology with a story called The Good Life. And that one was an amazing story, but a bit too long to read in this format here. Unfortunately, that volume is out of print. But if you happen to get your hands on one, find it at like A Books or some other used bookstore, give that a look, and I think you will be impressed, just like the rest of us were impressed with Laura. So let's get right to Laura's story, and then when we're done with the story, we'll have a short talk with Laura. Shadow Boxes by Laura Hawley. 1. A catastrophic reaction. In the living room, during TV hours, watching a sitcom, who knows what it's about, there's Larry on the love seat, Dorothy on the couch with Bob, sharing a paint by number, Esther on the other couch, Mr. Fine in his white shirt and sky blue suit in the rocking chair, feet flat on the floor, chair completely still. He keeps his nails immaculate, a source of compliments from the ladies. Someone says he was a surgeon. Imagine his hands stained with blood, his fingers massaging a seized heart, but then examine his perfect nails. Who would ever believe he was a doctor? Mr. Fine, with the thin silver hair trimmed once a week at the beauty parlor, he becomes distressed when he sees the sign on the door that reads Beauty Parlor, and so on Wednesday afternoons, the ladies tape another sign over it that reads Barber. He comes in wearing his sky blue suit and white shirt, tells Adam, "The usual, sir," and sits down in that chair, his personal throne. Besides those three words, he never says much to anyone. In the living room, watching a sitcom, who knows what it's about, a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test. And Mr. Fine jumps out of his chair, crouches low in the center of the room, waves his arms around his head. "Evacuate immediately! Seek shelter on the east side! We're being shelled!" Dorothy and Bob spill red paint all over the couch, and Bob begins to wail that he's been hit. Esther gets up from her seat, asks if anyone has seen her purse. Larry laughs and laughs, grabs Dorothy by the arm, and starts a waltz. Sometime later, everyone is calmed down and back in their rooms. During the night, Mr. Fine breaks into the beauty parlor, unlocks a drawer with a hairpin, steals a straight razor, and cuts his beautiful hands to shreds. Early morning, his immaculate nails crimson, he whispers, "I've lost my wedding ring. Could you help me find it, please?" Neighborhoods. The building is divided into four neighborhoods: Boathouse, blue; Country Lane, mauvish; Garden Path, green; and Cottage Place, supposed to be peach. The doors leading to each of these neighborhoods resemble house fronts, with faux windows and flower boxes, mailboxes, street signs. The recognition of color, a home remembered. 5 to 10 people in each house, each person with their own room and door that does not lock from the inside. On the doors are nameplates, more for their benefit than the visitors. Beside the doors are shadow boxes filled with pictures and cards. Sophie, a frail widow in Boathouse, has her shadow box crammed with Cary Grant. One picture with an autograph. She isn't in any of them. Sometimes she stops her neighbors on their way to the dining room, tells them, "Look at these pictures," she whispers and giggles, tells stories about how she and Jonathan took camping trips in Yellowstone every summer. "Isn't he handsome?" she whispers, and points to a picture of Grant. "He's coming this Tuesday to pick me up for lunch. I'll have to get my face done before he gets here. Maybe one day he will arrive to take her to lunch." Jeannie of Country Lane has in her shadow box pictures of family, their names written on scraps of paper pasted below each face. Carly, her granddaughter, when she was a baby. Her daughter, Lucy, the one in the hideous yellow dress beside her. Thomas, Lucy's husband. Here's a handsome young man in an Air Force uniform. Below the photograph, Scotty, March 6, 1990, 3 days before he got killed. Her parents' wedding photo, which she's always loved. Her mother was so beautiful. Her name was Cassandra, and her father's was Stephen. A black and white of Jeannie's late husband, George. A picture of herself when she was a young girl. The ladies laugh because she wrote her own name beneath it, and she laughs with them. But sometimes she wonders, who is that ridiculous girl on that ski slope? What is she doing on that mountain? Who knows what it's called? And then she recognizes her name. There still remains doubt when her eyes meet the old woman in the glass, so unlike the young girl who shares her name. Routines. There's Larry, who wanders into breakfast wearing 4 sweaters and 3 pairs of socks. Sometimes his sweaters are on backwards, but no one notices. The nurses smile and ask him, "Ain't you hot, Larry?" He'll stop and stare at them, say, "I think I am." Then they help him to shed his layers. If it's not Larry, it's someone else, and the nurses do their best to get them dressed properly. First thing after breakfast, they set out for the activities. Some sit and listen to Angie read the paper, and sometimes someone will ask, "What is happening to Eisenhower?" And Angie will say, "No, sweetie, he's not in the paper today." After Angie has read the paper, Jeannie of Country Lane asks to keep it. She hides it between her mattresses, where she also keeps loose articles from years past. A few days later, she will return to it, scan the obituaries, which remind her that she is not yet dead. But every day, she opens the papers with shaking hands, then refolds it and stuffs them back between the mattresses. Other people like doing the crosswords or hangman games that Elizabeth puts up on a projector machine. They work together to solve the puzzles. Sometimes this takes all morning. "Would you like to guess the next letter?" Used to be so good with words. Esther of Garden Path has lunch with her eldest son, Bill, every Wednesday at 11:30. And every week, Esther asks, "Why didn't you come last week?" And Bill replies, "I did, Mom. Remember? We went to Black Eyed Pea." Now he only apologizes, then kisses her cheek. Today, Esther enters the foyer with a paper sack in her arms. She hands over the sack to a nurse and says, "Here, you take these. I don't need them anymore. You go ahead and send the rest of my things through the mail." "What's in the sack, Mom?" "Odds and ends. What of it?" "We're only going to lunch." "Lunch?" "Where are you going, Esther?" the nurse asks. "Michigan. Come on, Bob. We need to get on the road. I have things to take care of at the house." "Esther? Bill's not taking you to Michigan today." "Is that so?" "The traffic is awful right now, and besides, it's supposed to snow tonight. Now, go on to lunch. You can leave in the morning." "That sounds acceptable." Esther surrenders her sack. Bill smiles at the nurse and says, "Can I speak with you for a moment?" please. They go around the corner where they will not be seen. Esther stands and worries over a loose thread on her slacks. Dorothy, of Cottage Place, waits for her husband, Charlie, in the dining room. He brings a box of photos twice a week, which he and Dorothy sort through, paste into albums. They sit at a small table by the window overlooking a courtyard with hedges and flower gardens. Most times, they can sit there for no more than an hour. Sometimes, Dorothy cannot focus for much longer. Sometimes, Charlie cannot keep from crying when she tells him how much he reminds her of her Charlie, who died years ago. From his bench in the center of the courtyard, the window frames the couple, a fading sequence of film. Charlie's hands shake as he takes out each photograph, points to faces, while Dorothy nods, turns to smile at him. Shadows flicker on glass, the scene replays and replays, and then the sun will angle low enough to burn out the image, now a black screen. In Dorothy's room are five large albums, with every photo labeled by name, date, and location. In Larry's favorite corner of the recreation room, past the reading table, opposite the door to the kitchen, he drags a chair over to another empty chair and sits talking with his wife. He says she wears a simple dress, sometimes blue, sometimes white, and her hair is always dark brown and curled. How are the boys? I'll see what I can do. I might have to work late tonight. I don't want to fight. I never get to see you. Why don't you tell me what you did today?
The one with the flowers.
When I get home, we'll hang it over the fireplace. Why don't you paint me a picture of you and the boys so I can keep it here for company? Paint me a picture of you smiling, and the boys, too. B? Help me. I can't stand this slipping. One of the nurses finds Larry, half asleep, scribbling into his notepad.
Hi there, Larry. Did you have a nice chat with B?
I'm very tired.
Of course you are.
Let's get you to bed. She takes Larry by the arm and leads him to his room in Garden Path. He tucks his notebook into his waistband and keeps one hand fisted over it. When Myron, of Country Lane, first saw Larry in the corner of the recreation room, he came up to Larry and asked what he was doing. Larry answered, and Myron told him that he was talking to a blank wall. It took three nurses to pull Larry's thick fingers from Myron's neck, which had a chain of deep bruises for nearly 2 weeks. Now, after his undisturbed visits with B, Larry records every word that passes between them before he falls into sleep, where everything is lost again. In her room in Country Lane, Jeannie is sorting through her stack of articles and newspapers, and here's an article about a young man in the Air Force who was beaten to death outside a bar. His name was Scott Rabinowitz, and he was 31 years old. Why is she running down the halls? Why is she scratching at her face, crying like a child? Doesn't she understand that this paper is 3 years old? A catastrophic reaction, too. Sometime after lunch, Esther went wandering. She walked around the recreation room, down the hallways in Country Lane, and ended up here, in this room. I have to get home. I have to get home. With each refrain, her voice rises. Soon she is in tears. Esther, this is your home now.
No. Who are you? What have you done with my Billy? Where am I? This isn't my house. What are you doing in my house?
A dark stain spreads on her slacks. She pulls at her hair.
Where's Billy? Where's Billy? He was supposed to come home straight after school. This isn't like him. I have to get home. God damn it, bitch. Why won't you let me go home?
Listen to the nurses running down the halls outside, the suction of the door lock being released. Esther's open palms connecting with anything in her path, swift slaps at walls, face, shoulder. Who can understand what she's screaming now? The nurses arrive, take Esther out of this room. She squirms in their grasp, turns and yells, "Help me, please!" In those few seconds, something new slips into her eyes, an awareness never before seen here, in this building, in this room, in this time.
Something inside Esther knows she's slipping, knows every time her son leaves her after lunch on Wednesdays, when the lights go out, and there is nothing left but fractured memory, and that something is always trying to pull her away, making her slip, and she's losing. And she knows this now, in these few moments. After the hall is quiet, still again, the shadow boxes lining the walls, a string of mirrors reflecting off each other the private memories of children and spouses, birthdays, vacations, names that become permanent in the letters tacked beneath faces. In this shadow box, by this door in Country Lane, a pair of pale blue eyes in the glass, beside the flat image of a young woman on a ski slope. She is crooked on the skis, too long for her to control, and still she smiles. This photo is mine, before the years disappeared beneath that snow, the dimming eyes in the glass, my own eyes, not so like the eyes in the photograph, but like Esther's, and Dorothy's, and Mr. Fine's. In their shadow boxes, I see what is becoming, in mine, what will soon be forgotten. Those eyes on the mountain, these eyes in the glass. We stare through each other until there is no recognition. There are only eyes, after all, and I will no longer claim them. Hey.
Hey.
This is Jason.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Are you safe at home or are you still on the road?
I just got home, actually. Good timing.
Sweet. All right.
Yeah.
You've had a much longer day than I have.
Oh.
So,
that's all right.
We won't go too long on this.
Okay.
And also kind of in the chronology of things.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone just got done listening to me read your story, Shadow Boxes.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with this question. What do you have to say for yourself?
I have no idea. What do you mean?
No, that's just it.
What do I have to say for myself?
What do you have to say for yourself?
I don't know. It was a story I wrote a while ago.
Yeah, it was... over a decade ago.
Yeah, I think it was post-Naropa. No, it wasn't post-Naropa. It was Naropa. Because that was
yeah.
in my thesis.
Because yeah, I remember so reading it.
That was 15 years ago.
Yeah. Now,
it's
not that scary. I want to make some connections here with this one. Now, your mother is in nursing.
Yep.
And... was doing a lot of work with Alzheimer's patients, correct?
Correct.
And you're now, instead of writing, going into nursing.
Correct.
Are you also going to be working with Alzheimer's patients?
As a very big possibility, I will be.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've had the opportunity to work with some in a nursing home that I worked at.
Uh-huh.
And, it's an experience. It really is. It's just, it's something else. People are just gone.
Yeah.
They're not there. They're not themselves anymore.
I'm interested here, old buddy.
Yeah.
Do you think that blankness is something that, because it's, I remember your fiction always having a hint of the mentally unstable to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of your characters were a little less
off.
Than normal.
Yes.
Do you think maybe you're... We'll get into some other things here, but do you think the reason you're pursuing this now is because there's always been this appeal to that in your psyche? Related to this blankness, to this off-kilter thing?
I think so. Even with nursing now, the field that's drawing me in is psych.
Ah.
I did a clinical rotation at an inpatient mental facility up in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely loved it. I just loved it. I had a 3-hour conversation with a guy who was so manic. He was like Brad Pitt from 12 Monkeys. I'm like, I met him. he was so gone, and I just loved it. I was like, this is fantastic. I think I just, that connection there, you know, I've always had it, and it's, I think I always will.
Okay, so here's some questions that I have for you.
Okay.
One. Why haven't you been writing? I mean, aside from the busyness of the clinical, but
yeah. Well, that's only been the last year and a half. I haven't mm-hmm. been writing for a lot longer than that. I've been asking myself that a lot. Finding all these stories and these files, just kind of, I was so excited. I couldn't contain myself. I'm just like, oh my God, I remember writing this. I remember doing this. I remember doing
right.
that. And just like, why did I stop doing it? And I wish I knew.
Yeah.
I wish I knew.
I wish I knew too. I think Gavin wishes he knew, and
yeah.
and Jen and.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I think I had a plot twist
Whoops,
in my
there?
Life just recently. Yeah, you there?
Okay.
Okay. Sure I had a
something.
Plot twist in my life recently that will inspire me to start writing again. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just tell you, I was actually diagnosed with thyroid cancer.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so it's kind of a shocker. That was, I found out on Thursday. And just kind of blew me away. I was like, I mean, it's an easily treatable cancer.
Right.
It's still cancer.
Yeah. It's
so,
holy shit, Laura.
Yeah.
Jesus.
So I've got school going on. I got that going on. And I'm just like, I want to write. Why am I not writing? This is what I want to do.
Right.
And I think this little scare has kind of put a lot of things into perspective.
That. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I wasn't expecting that.
Wasn't expecting that one, were you?
No. Oh,
yeah.
Good grief, Laura.
Yeah.
So it's they caught it early, right? I mean, it's relatively early, and it's an easy cancer.
It should be, yeah. I found it, actually. I found a lump and went to the doctor right away, and then the process went through, and they found that it was cancer. And it's progressing. The treatment mm-hmm. is progressing really quickly. So it should be just a surgery and, God forbid, some radiation. But
right.
And then I'll
wow.
be done. And fine, totally survivable.
Right.
It doesn't spread very quickly. So.
And you quit smoking.
Oh, yeah. It's been 4 years.
Good.
Yep. 4 years. Yeah. I know.
Shit. Okay. My other question, Captain Thyroid. So one of the things that's been bugging me for years, and I know that at the time we resolved it and got past it. But the thing that's still, particularly since you haven't been writing, that's kind of always kind of crept around in the back of my mind is that little kerfuffle we had after the Best New American Voices anthology, when you got picked up by the agent.
Oh,
and
yes.
we just kind of went
yeah.
left on everything, you know. I didn't know what was going on with you, and you were thinking that, I don't know what you were thinking, but it was like, you know, and let me see. Here's where it ties into. I was visiting an old friend of mine, Jesse, that I'd known since the third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And we were grown-ups, we were adults, and I went down to visit him, and he told me this story that one time when, you know, we were at school and it was some gym class PE's competition thing or whatever, I don't remember if it was a running thing or a sports something, whatever, I don't know. He ended up beating me. Which, you know, wouldn't normally be a horrible thing, but the story he told me was that he won in this particular competition, and that I didn't talk to him for 2 days. And So he always let me win after that. And I still, whenever I think about that story, I feel like such an awful, horrible shit. You know?
Yeah.
And then after he told me that story, we went over to his father-in-law's house where there was an air hockey table, and he proceeded to kick my ass for 2 hours at air hockey. So
payback, right?
I got what was coming to me, right?
Yep.
So we had our little kerfuffle, and the thing, and this is where I either want someone to say, yeah, you were an asshole, or you quit thinking you're the center of the universe, you self-important asshole. One of these two, because, you know, even though we worked it out, and the truth was, is that I never resented you for that success and for landing the agent. Mm-hmm. You know, I was happy for you, but what I was struggling with was my sense of personal failure.
Yeah.
You know, that's never going to happen to me. And it wasn't like, I don't like her for doing that. That's never going to happen to me. And so there's always been this little thing in the back of my mind that even though we ironed that out when it happened, there's always this thing in the back of my mind where I was thinking to myself, did she stop writing because of that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think I would have stopped anyway. I don't know what happened. I think it was overwhelming. I didn't feel ready for it. I didn't have anything finished. I was, you know, it was kind of like, oh, here you go. Like, oh crap, now what? And then I think it was my own fear of failure that stopped me.
Yeah, kind of that sudden rush of,
yeah, you know, like, oh my god,
story and Joyce Carol Oates and
done. You know,
right.
And I just kind of, yeah,
froze up. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I can see where that happens, because you hear. You don't really hear stories, but you kind of get the impression from a lot of young writers that have a sudden success and then you never hear from them again that, well, no, it's actually the Harper Lee conundrum, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that one tremendous, huge success right out of the gate. And then,
how do you top it? What do you do?
Right. Yeah. Well, Best New American Voices was not the Pulitzer.
No, it was Laura not. Harley. It was nothing. It was just a little anthology that you can't even find anymore.
Yeah, it's out of print. So you're free.
Yeah,
you have been set free. So beat the cancer.
Yeah.
Finish the nursing thing and get to writing, because
I don't think
the world will be a safe or warm and comfortable place until you're writing and publishing.
I don't know about that, but it would be nice to start writing again. It's almost like running to the end of a diving board and you stop. Because you're so exhilarated to just about take that leap, but then you're scared shitless because you're like at the end of the diving board and you're about to fall 12 feet or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of how I feel when I start thinking about writing. I'll get these surges, like I'm running towards the end, and all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, wait, nope. And then it goes away.
Yeah.
But
Well, call me when you feel stuck, because I'll kick you in the ass.
I know. You're good at that. You always kept me on track. I appreciate that very much.
I was reading your story, you know, and recording it, I kept thinking to myself, I know where this came from. I know, and I know some of the artistic influences behind it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, you know, with the group of people that we were associated with in grad school, there was a certain dynamic, a way that we played off of each other.
Oh, yeah.
That we challenged each other. That, you know, Gavin's still writing and I can still find his stuff and I can see what Jen's doing and Evan's not writing and you're not writing and, you know, Michelle's writing and
everybody's very successful, especially Michelle.
And, Ronnie is still writing. Veronica Corpus.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Delia is still writing, doing stuff up in San Francisco. And there's stuff I can go to and play off of. But for me, the most important one was you, because it was like, oh, if I can get a character that's as emotionally complex as the ones that Laura comes up with, even half as complex or fleshed out, then I'm doing okay. You know, you were kind of my measuring stick on that.
Oh.
And so, you know, it's just damn selfishness really that I want you to write again. because when you were writing, it made me, when you were writing, it made me better. So I need you to write some more.
That's a lot of motivation right there.
All right. I'm here doing what I can.
Yep. I do appreciate it. I really do.
Are you worn out today?
No, not really.
After
it was a long day, but
okay.
Not too bad. Yeah.
Have you had dinner yet?
Yeah.
Have you had dinner yet? Yeah.
Yeah. Small one. A little bit to eat. Learning to eat, not very much.
Yeah. Well, keep me posted on the treatment.
Let me know what's
going on there.
Yep. I find out tomorrow about surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be the next big step.
Well, I will meditate and send good thoughts your way for that one.
Oh, thank you. I'll need them.
I don't want to say that I'll pray because I'm not really the praying type.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I'd wonder who you are.
It's about as close as I can get.
I'd be like, what?
My God, he went back to Kansas and the Bible got in.
I know.
The Bible didn't get in. Right? Oh, good grief.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm gonna let you go here.
Okay.
And you get on with and get some rest. But don't go away just yet. Once I shut this off, I still want to talk to you for a second.
Okay, sure.
So thanks for letting me read your story to my audience.
It.
And this
should
go up. No problem. It should go up late tonight or early tomorrow morning.
Very cool.
Just depends on how motivated I feel after we get off the phone here.
Yeah, it's late there.
Okay, so thanks, Laura. Say goodbye to the listeners.
Goodbye.
All right. There we have it. A brief conversation and a story from Laura Hawley. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to come back in a couple of weeks where I'll have my conversation, I believe, with Timothy Shaffert, the author of The Swan Gondola, as among many other books. So see you in a couple of weeks.